This is an interview with Paul Mendels at the Nut Shop Factory at 20 to 26 Allen Street in Waterloo on Friday the 30th of April 2010. The interview is being recorded as part of the City of Sydney's Oral History Project, Commerce and Work in the City of Sydney, and the interviewer is Rosalind Burge. Paul, thank you for your time this afternoon for this project. And if we could just start with some personal details, when you were born and where?
I was born in Germany in 1927, and in a little place, a village actually, called which is in northwest Germany, not far from the Dutch border.
And you left there when you were about 11, I understand.
Yes, we left early in 1939, after the so-called Kristallnacht, which sort of thrashed the houses of Jews in Germany and burned synagogues and so on. And when we went via Holland, had relatives in Holland where we stayed a few weeks, and then came by boat to Australia.
Did your family elect to come to Australia, or was that just a happen chance?
No, we originally wanted to go to America, where my mother had a lot of relations, but my father also had a brother in Australia. But after the so-called Kristallnacht, it was just whoever would have us first. And the landing permit for Australia came, I think, a week before the one for America, and we decided to go with it.
Did you have other brothers and sisters?
I have a sister who also came. We came out of the family, my father, my mother, my sister and myself. My sister's 5 years younger than I am.
Did you come straight to Sydney?
Yes, we came straight to Sydney.
Do you remember that arrival?
Very much so. Particularly even, we came not through Perth in those days, but we came down from Darwin. Our first port of call was Thursday Island. And I thought, my God, what are we in for? There was absolutely nothing, not even, you know, native shacks. And then Darwin was not much of a city in those days either. But then the next port of call was Brisbane, and I was very impressed coming from a village that Brisbane actually had, for those days, skyscrapers and trams.
And then on to Sydney. You mentioned you had other family here. Were they here before you came?
Yes, I had an uncle who was here before. He came out in 1936.
Was he involved in the confectionery business?
Not at all.
And your father wasn't either?
No, my father wasn't either.
What was his profession?
He was a cattle dealer, buying and selling cattle from the, like buying cattle from the farmers and selling it at the markets.
It's a very different
aspect of
business.
Very different.
How did he come to be working in the confectionery business?
He was, when he first came, we arrived here in April of 1939. He worked for a while as a removalist with a big truck and furniture removalist, and really that didn't suit, and he was looking for a business to buy, and this business in the Strand Arcade run by the Declines was for sale, and that appealed to him and he bought it.
Had he started working there or any experience of working in that sort
not
of industry?
Not at all.
Did you know the family?
No. But you had a common bond because they were also refugees from Germany at the time. Mm.
So they hadn't had the shop for very long either?
I think about 2 years. But he was not a well man, and he just couldn't handle the physical work. And that didn't worry my father at all. He was a fairly big, strong man, and he could do that. And part of the conditions, and I have the original sort of agreement that was drawn up between just an accountant and who was a sort of a relation, and the Declines, and it provided that they teach my father the trade.
Did your father enjoy that business?
Yes, he did. He did. He liked to work with the public, and he was fairly outgoing, and that was the sort of business where you could.
And did you work in the business at all?
Almost from the beginning. I was 11 years old, and in the very early days, it was late night shopping on a Friday, and there would be no one. There would be someone at home, but we usually came into the city to meet. I came into the city. I had a cousin who also came with me at the time, and we went into the city and helped in the business, actually cooking nuts by hand. That was the way it started.
Could you tell me about that process? It must be so different today. What was the process like then?
It's not very different. It's probably much the same, except nowadays nobody lifts anything. It's all done mechanically. Nobody stirs anything. It's all done mechanically. And it was all done by hand and fairly small things. People said, oh, what a large copper pot. But it was around about, I suppose the weight was about 5 pounds, which was about just over 2 kilos. And that was sort of stirred and cooked. And then we used to put the product on trays right in the front of the window and separate them, much the way we do now, and then sold them. And people used to wait for a particular batch because they didn't want the one cooked 10 minutes earlier that was stale.
Are people just as fussy today?
I suppose they are, yes.
So what sort of things did you sell then in the 1930s and 40s?
Well, we bought the business actually in January of 1940 because the Declines wanted to have the Christmas business. But my father was there already from November, but the actual transfer wasn't until the first week of January, I think, of 1940. And the main product was what we now call Vienna garments. They were in those days Vienna garments, but during the war, Vienna wasn't that popular. People didn't differentiate between Austria and Germany, so we couldn't call them Vienna garments, and we called them vanilla garments.
Are they still called vanilla garments today?
Well, some people come in and still say vanilla garments, but some of the oldies, but no, but then we changed back to Vienna garments sometime later. And now we call them candy garments because many of the tools think they're imported from Vienna. Hmm.
Did you experience any difficulties yourself, any racism or abuse at that time?
Not very much, but of course we were called FOs. That was the thing at the time, and obviously you dressed and acted a little differently, and it took some time till we got used to the Australian way. Mm. And as kids at school making new friends, it didn't take long, and I had no personal difficulty, no.
Where did you grow up?
In Randwick. We lived in Arthur Street, Randwick, and we went to Randwick Public School and later on to Sydney High, and we stayed in that area till about 1943, I think, and then we moved to East Lakes.
Are you still on this side of the harbour?
No. When I married, we moved to Middle Cove at first.
So when you finished school, was it obvious that you would go into the business, or were there other choices available?
No, I had no intention of going into the business originally, but that was a time when it was very difficult to get staff and labour was hard to get, and the business was thriving. It was only the one shop, and you just couldn't get staff. During the war also, I worked during school, after school, and Saturday mornings to help my father. And my father said, well, for a year you can defer going to university and help in the shop. And I wanted to study science, actually. But after working for 6 months, see what you could earn, and realizing that scientists were then, as now, very poorly paid unless you were really someone special, I thought, no, it's not for me. And
were there any family pressures brought to bear?
My mother insisted that I do something else, so I did a couple of years of accountancy at night. She felt I should have some other profession.
And, of course, your own family are now in the business as well.
Yes, I have my son and daughter. My son is an architect by profession. He also worked for a few years and then came in. I had a bypass about 25 years ago now, and then decided that either come in or we sold the business, and he took a while to make his mind up, but he did come in, and my daughter had come back from a trip after being married there with 18 months honeymoon. And when they came back, I said, look, it's, I think, September or sometime. You won't get a job this side of Christmas. Come in, give me a hand till after Christmas, which they did. My daughter and my son-in-law. And we worked together. My son-in-law later decided to opt out. He had minor difference with my son on how to run the business. But he kept his shares in the business, and he's still a director of the business, but he's doing other things.
Very much a family concern
very
still.
Much, yes, very much so. And I have also, I had my granddaughter, she was now 24, from the time she was about 17 till in the early 20s, gave me a hand on Thursday nights, and that was very good. And now I have Dan's older son, grandson, who is 16, or nearly 17, and he's helping me Thursday nights.
Thursday nights in the shop in town?
Yes.
So how long do you spend working in the shop yourself?
Now, I go in mostly on Thursdays and on Fridays from about 10 to 4, half past 4, occasionally a little bit more. And on Mondays, I come here, if there's anything here, mostly do the banking or some of the banking and whatever else is necessary. We usually have a sort of director's meeting or whatever it is, and that's till lunchtime.
So how long are you in the shop on Thursdays?
Till about half past 6.
So because in the afternoon,
yeah,
and evening.
Yeah. So I come later sometimes, but at the moment it's half past 6 because we have a different crew coming to work the night, and they have to have lunch.
Yes.
They have to have dinner, rather. So while they go to eat, I'm there.
What do you do when you're in the shop?
Well, I look after the customers.
So you're standing on your feet for that time?
Oh, yes.
You're not 21. That's quite a long time to be standing on your feet.
It doesn't seem to worry me.
Oh, that's terrific. So, during the 40s, you mentioned that labour was hard to...
Very difficult to get, yes.
...get. So, was there anyone else outside the family helping you at that time?
We had one girl who stayed with us for quite a while. She's since passed away and then married to Melbourne, who helped us. And then occasionally we'd be able to get somebody else, but the manpower people directed people to you. And that's all we could get.
Yes. So how many people would you need in the shop then, say?
Well, usually we needed 4. So before I was there, there was this lady and another girl, and my mother used to come in.
That's quite a small space.
Very small.
And your stock, how did you work around all of that?
Well, we didn't have so many lines. We had only the Vienna almonds and one that we now call sugared peanuts, a red one. And we had some chocolate lines. I think there were about 3, chocolate marzipan, chocolate prunes, chocolate brandy prunes, and covered the Vienna almonds and chocolate. We called them chocolate almonds. We did that first thing in the morning before it got really warm. And then I put the chocolates in the fridge to cool them. And then from about 9:30, 10 o'clock onwards, only the Vienna almonds.
I'm really surprised thinking you to keep 4 people with an income. You must have sold a tremendous number of nuts.
We did in those years.
More for the number of lines that you had than today?
It was very busy. We were only open 2 or 3 hours a day. The rest of the time we were manufacturing. And people queued up because everything was in short supply. You couldn't get sugar, you couldn't get almonds, you couldn't get anything. So it was all, we even rationed things. In other words, during the war years, customers were rationed to 1/4 pound of Vienna almonds. And if they were in uniform, they could get 1/2 pound. So.
And where did you source your chocolate and your almonds from?
Well, the chocolate came from Small's Chocolates in Bridge Road.
Yes.
And I often remember that when the deliveries were only once a week or something, and if we ran out, I'd have to go down on the bike and get a 20-pound slab of chocolates on the bike and from Bridge Street, Stanmore, and bring it back to Strand Arcade. And the almonds were quite difficult because they were also very short supply. And my father went to Griffith, and he had a local stock and station agent there who helped him go around the farms, and there were often Italian farms who grew them at the sideline, and they'd buy the almonds, throw them on the back of the truck, and then they'd come to a cracking plant in Sydney who was a relation to the stock and station agent where there was a cracking plant, and we had them cracked there, and often helped with the cracking as well because you couldn't get labour on a Saturday morning. And
where was the cracking plant, Paul?
Where the North Shore Hospital is now. What's it called? The street in...
Herbert Street.
Herbert Street, St. Leonard's. Exactly right.
Ah.
In Herbert Street, St. Leonard's.
Is that what they did, just crack nuts?
No, they also were agents for... And our Verity prunes, they're still going, sort of. That's how the chocolate prunes came into it, because they were the agents for prunes, so we could get the prunes and make the chocolate go to prunes.
And did you brandy them yourselves?
Yes, but all we do with them is just sort of soak them overnight in brandy, drain the brandy off and chocolate coat them.
Would you drink the brandy?
Pardon?
Would you drink the brandy after that?
No, it just was absorbed. It was nearly all absorbed.
Yes.
If there was any left, you could leave it till next time, till the next lot came in.
And I'm very interested, not only in just in the shop, but how the things came to you. Would you also import nuts?
No, not at that time. But what happened fairly soon after that, and this was even during the war years, it was very... people moved out of Sydney, you might have heard. The Japanese were going to come, and a lot of the shops in Strand Arcade were empty, and actually Strand Arcade got quite neglected. And so, first of all, they gave us a shop next door, the so-called storeroom. And then later on, when business began to pick up again, that wasn't good enough, and we took several rooms on the first floor that we no longer manufactured in the shop. And I'm talking now about 1944-45 onwards, and we had one room where we made our chocolate, which had fridges in it. We didn't have air conditioning, it wasn't as popular at that time. And the other room was a room where we did our cooking of Vienna almonds and similar things.
It must have been very hot.
Well, it was, yes. Mm. Yes.
What were some of the other shops in the Strand Arcade at that time?
Oh, there were a lot of... what are the people who made hats? What's the name for it?
Milliners.
Milliners. That was... Strand Arcade was known for that.
Yes.
There would have been four or five different milliners. There were tailors, watchmakers, and I think there were also two very big delicatessen shops, Sylvester's and...
Oh,
the other one, they were changed. It's all changed. Nowadays, we've got all these bulk, enormous Coles and Woolies supermarkets that didn't exist in those days, so you had the specialty shops.
So the delicatessens, would they have sold conventional Australian things, so-called, like, what's that? I'm trying to think of that loaf. Devon,
yes,
loaf.
That was about all you could get. You could Devon or Berliner, but it was both the same. It tasted exactly the same. Yes, of course, small goods and some sort of sausages, chocolate sausages to barbecue and to sell, cheeses, but they also cooked chickens at the time, and hams, of course, for Christmas. That was a big thing. I remember the days before Christmas, they were working 24 hours a day because they were cooking them, and nobody went home.
The smells in the Strand Arcade must have been quite different to today.
Oh,
the
yes.
smells of food and chocolate and hams.
Very much so, yes.
I can remember, even in my time in the city, where there were European delicatessens. And I was thinking about Circular Quay the other day, where you could get wonderful rissoles and that sort of thing. Yeah. Did those delicatessens sell
items? Yes, not only that. I mean, they sold sergeant's pies. In those days, everybody loved sergeant's pies. But they also made a lot of their own things, like rissoles and cooked chickens and so on, specialist things. And Sylvester's now had their own factory.
Is that where you would have your lunch?
No, at that time we bought lunch.
You bought it in with you?
Yes. I think most people did, to go out for lunch. I mean, if you went to Carl's or Rebens or one of these places, that was something special. There were no lunch places like food courts now. The one thing I know, remember very vividly, on a Friday night, whoever was working there got tea money, and we all went to Fernandez, which was a fish shop in Pitt Street, just near King Street. And it was a special event for me. I always looked forward to that. And that's before they had the brownout. It would have been about 1941 or 42. 42, I suppose, it happened. But then after that, there was no more late shopping on Friday nights.
Was the business ever in a state of decline in the 40s when you thought you might have to do something else, or your father thought that?
We were lucky that it never really happened. And I must say, we had a lot of other business, other shops, retail shops. Later on, we built a factory, and we had up to 9 retail shops.
Goodness.
At one stage, yes.
Where were they?
Oh, there were two in Bankstown Square and Compass Centre. There was one at Roselands. We had one at Australia Square. We had one on Wynyard Station. Or the first one, actually, was in George Street, opposite the cinemas, where the Trocadero used to be. Cinemas are still there. But you can't compare now to what it was then. I worked in that shop for a long time on Saturdays, and when the theatres emptied, and there were about 6 or 8 theatres on either side of the street, that the George Street, you couldn't walk just on the footpath. The theatres all emptied at the same time, and half the street was taken over with pedestrians. It's quite different.
Yes.
There were a lot of people went in there, and the concerts were at the town hall. So that part of town was really a big entertainment area, and that shop was very good for a while. That's between Bathurst and Liverpool Street, facing the railway on the left-hand side, opposite the Trocadero.
Right, right. Because I suppose your nuts, chocolates are very easy things to eat in a film or a concert.
Oh, yes, I suppose so.
Would people...
People used to come before and buy it. Yes, exactly. Yes, but I mean, theatres also all had candy bars, as they do now, and people with trays. But yes, people did come out at interval, and particularly came before they went in and bought things. It was a very good shop for a while.
So why did you close it?
Well, first of all, once television came, you could say that part of the business dropped by a third. And then once you got videos, another third went, and the whole theatre business went. There were no people, wasn't as busy anymore. The Century is now still an empty hole, you know, that's pulled down. Mm. And some of those theatres held 2,000 people. Hmm. Certainly the Century did. Not the Century, sorry, the Regent. The Regent was the biggest
one. Oh, yes, yes.
But all of those, there were so many theatres along there.
So when did you close that shop? In the 70s?
Not sure when I closed it. And I think it would be even earlier. That particular one was even earlier. In the 60s, or late 60s, my wife was always the relief girl for these shops. Somebody turned in sick and she went there. And she finally said, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I thought, well, no way I can do it any other way. And I sold, I think, 4 shops within about 6 months and sold them to my staff. Or at least 3 of them I sold to staff. More or less told them, if you don't want it, I buy it back for the same price. And they bought the things that we manufactured in the factory for me, and anything else that we didn't make, they could buy wherever they wanted to. And that went on for a number of years. And the one in George Street in particular, we did very well. And the girl that took it over actually went to Tasmania. She opened another shop there, and we supplied her there for a few years. Mm. But that site was redeveloped, and they made her an offer just too good to refuse. Mm.
Is she still selling your product in Tasmania?
No, it was about 3 or 4 years, and then I think children needed her more, and she didn't.
Was there ever a time, well, perhaps going backwards, you grew and grew, and you had your factory in Surry Hills. When did that begin?
Factory in Surry Hills would have been about, I'm just thinking, it would have been the late 50s.
Whereabouts in Surry Hills?
In Buckingham Street, 21 Buckingham Street. There's a block of flats there now.
That must have been such a different atmosphere in that part of the town now.
Well, it was actually, yes. At the time, we built the factory. We wanted something close to the city because I could go from the city, from the factory to the city shops, because we had shop in Australia Square, shop at Wynyard Station, shop in George Street, and the city. That was 4 shops. I could be there any time in quarter of an hour if needed. Mm. And easy to supply. Yes, it was a different time.
Is the shop in Wynyard? It's a long time since I've caught a train.
No.
There?
All I have left now is a shop at Strand Arcade, and we have a shop at the factory here. I think retailing has changed. When I sold my shop to my staff, I made more money, they made more money, because with the regulations the way it is, if you couldn't have one by themselves in the shop, you needed 2 girls, you needed someone to change for lunch, someone for Thursday nights. And just as an example, the shop in Bankstown that I sold, the girl did particularly well. She ran the shop completely by herself. She had a friend that came in at lunchtime, gave her a break at lunchtime, and I think she employed a couple of casual schoolgirls for Saturday mornings. And that suited everybody. And it was half the expenses. And if you consider the wages you saved, it was enormous.
How did you deliver the product between from shop to shop?
We have a van. We still have now 2 vans.
Are they anonymous or are they?
No, we don't have a name on. My son always wants it, and I always feel doesn't make any difference.
You don't think that's an advertising tool?
Probably should have been, but I'm very conservative, and I felt no.
What other ways are you conservative in terms of the shop?
Well, we don't have a lot of changes. For instance, the shop looks, I'd like to keep it looking very much the way it did 10 or 15 years ago. Not always necessarily correct, but I feel people are used to it and they like to see something in Sydney that hasn't changed that much.
Do you have people, say, from the country or visitors who come back regularly from time to time and buy things?
Every week, or I could almost say every day, we have people coming that live overseas. Now, I'm glad you're still here. I used to live in Sydney 30 years or 40 years ago, and so on. Actually, as a matter of fact, the person who worked with the declines came in, must be now about 5-6 years ago, and he's an old man, even older than I am. He would have been in his late 80s then. He came in, I just wondered whether he was still here, and walked in, and he's living in London, been living in London for 50 odd years, and come
goodness,
in since then.
Goodness.
It's quite a change.
Yes.
But every week, I would say, we have people coming, and we have particularly Asian people who come to Sydney once every 6 months on business. They come regularly, but also people coming from Bankstown or Hornsby, or people coming from the country who come in fairly regularly. And that's probably the basis of our business.
Is that right? Mm. People from out of town?
Yeah. Yes. They come regularly.
So is it because they come regularly or because they buy a ton of stuff?
Oh, well, see, the people... We've got either there or one lot of customers, and the others are the people living in town. The people who are living in the suburbs, really closer suburbs, they all have shopping centres. They all can all buy nuts at all of the supermarkets and so on. You don't get them as often, but the people coming from out of town can't buy quality nuts as much as they can if they were living in the city.
So, Paul, what makes your nuts quality nuts?
Well, I suppose it's the nuts we buy from and the farms we buy from. I mean, just at the moment, and I'd like to give you a sample when we've finished, we have some almonds. My father dealt with the father of the guy, the grandfather of the guy that Dan deals with now. So, and that's in, I think, Willunga in South Australia. And that particular variety of almonds isn't being planted anymore, and they don't keep the varieties the way they used to anymore because there's so many new varieties, and sometimes you can't even tell them apart. They look similar, but when you eat them, or particularly when you cook them, you can see the difference in them. You know, we're all used to red and green and yellow apples, but there's very many more varieties of almonds than apples. So it'll give you some idea, and they're all very different.
So what are the brand, what are the kind of almonds that you use when you say these are different? Do they have a name?
Yes, the ones we like best for... Some of our products are called Johnson, another one is called Bruce, and these are a dark almond. You wouldn't usually buy them in shops there. The skin is brown. You might remember the brown skins you used to get. Nowadays, the skins are all very light colored, and they have much better flavor, and they're usually larger, and for certain things, they're better. Whereas these light colored almonds vary very much. There are very many varieties of those as well. But people often ask us, why are your nuts taste different to others? Well, it's why do red apples taste different to green apples or this, but you have to know where to source them. And the same goes, we have a firm that I buy walnuts from and I've dealt with for many years.
Is that right?
Or in a region, actually. There are two farms there. They've changed farms recently, but they have a variety of walnuts called a Franquette. It's hardly being grown now because I grow macadamias and have been for 35 years. Everything is how many trees per hectare? How many kilos per tree, because you get paid so much, they don't really worry. But for us, it's essential to get that special taste.
Would you care to tell me for the record who that person is that supplies you the almonds, or is that something you'd rather not put on the record?
The person we dealt with originally was Nelson, and I've forgotten even the name, but we've dealt with almonds in Adelaide since... or I would say the late 1940s, when the almond co-op first started, we couldn't get almonds, and we used a lot of almonds, particularly these brownie almonds that were being grown at the time. And my father went over and had a contract with him to take so much, and so it suited the co-op, it suited us. Mm. And so we've got, look, after being so long in business, you know, you've got your connections, you know exactly what you want. And these almonds are really hard to get because they're not being planted anymore, these varieties. Mm. As I say, everything is how many kilos you get out of a hectare.
So how are they shipped across to you? By
road freight? Originally, it used to be by boat from Adelaide, and they'd end up at Darling Harbour or Walsh Bay along there.
Yes.
And I remember very vividly once going there when there was a strike on to see, we had absolutely no nuts. And in those days, the strikes always came before Christmas. And we were desperate to get the nuts, trying to persuade the wharfies, could I get the armours off the boat? I had no luck.
So how many would you be importing at that time? Importing, loose word, interstate.
Oh, at that time, 10 to 15 tons per year. It's not a lot compared to usage today.
Hmm. It still sounds a fair number.
But when you had to cook them all by hand, that was quite a bit.
Did you also have to remove the hull, or would the factory in Herbert Street do that for you?
No, when you say that, the skin? The skin. The skin, no. We don't remove that very much at all. We only use that for one line, but particularly for making marzipan. They have to be blanched, have to have it taken off.
Do you make your own marzipan?
Yes. When we originally started that, my father brought the nuts home and we cooked them on the stove at home and did it by hand. But that was going, and then about early 1950s, we bought a blanching machine, still in use now. We use it now for skinning the peanuts because the almonds are all done in Adelaide. Because they've got very big equipment. Mm. But yes, we can use it now, but we do about 100 kilos in about an hour and a half, and that's just not efficient. The big machines that fly through that, then you've got to dry them afterwards as well.
Mm. Is all that work, all that factory work done here in the premises in Waterloo?
Yeah, and it was done in Buckingham Street. But that we outgrew that, it was too small.
Is your business continuing to grow?
The wholesale side of it, yes. Mm. I'm happy to show you through later on if you'd like to.
I'd be very interested to see it, yes.
They've all gone home, there's no one working, but yes.
So what sort of businesses would you supply wholesale?
We supply some people who pack under their own name, and we supply a wholesaler who takes our chocolates and supplies it as nut shop chocolates, but also a lot of shops that in centres, for argument's sake, in the Hunter Valley and so on, they have little shops there, and often local things, people think they're made locally, but in fact we supply a lot of those. But we also supply a lot of pastry cooks with the nuts as kernel or as manufactured. We grind a lot of nuts for pastry cooks, and restaurants too, they take a lot of pine nuts, pistachio nuts and so on. So that's sort of a separate facet of our business.
Where do you source the pine nuts from?
China. At the moment, we used to get them from Portugal, but pine nuts have gone through the roof, so it's not a good time to talk about pine nuts.
They're always expensive, I think.
No, they weren't always, but lately, yes, at the moment. Yeah, they certainly have at the moment. People use them for making pesto, and the restaurants have got their menus printed, so you can't say, try and we'll suggest you use this or that, and they all say, yes, that's very good, but what about our menus? And we've got an advertised.
These things flow on.
Yes.
Looking at your website, I notice you have a variety of items and you have a particular packaging. Do you all do all that packaging yourselves and printing?
Yes, we did for quite a while, particularly when we were in Buckingham Street. Half of our business would have been supplying duty-free stores at the airport, because this is why I went into macadamias. Macadamias particularly for the Japanese were the big thing, and we supplied them also to the chains and exported them a little bit.
Where would you export them to, Paul?
The chocolate macadamias, I think, went to Japan to some little bit. We tried very hard to break into that market in a big way, but that didn't succeed. But we certainly supplied the chains here. And at the airport, that was quite big business for us. There's been a lot of changes at the airport now. There's, I think, three separate overseas terminals, but at that time it was all the one thing, and it was very big business for us. And we also supplied one packer who has since opened up his own factory, but he used to get a pallet of macadamias packed into trays, which he'd slip into his own boxes per day. And that was quite good business for us. It just came on the fax, this one, that one, that one, night, and then went out the next day. But that completely changed. That's no longer we no longer have a sort of worthwhile presence at the airport, international terminal, which is a pity because that was very good and quite a large volume in business.
Why have you elected not to be at the airport as well?
No, the airport has changed since Macquarie's taken it over. Those firms that we supplied don't have an outlet there anymore.
Oh, I see.
So we haven't been able to crack the new ones. Or we haven't really tried. We don't have we have no salesperson, never have had.
Is that right?
Yes. So it's only people who come to us, and so they haven't really tried that.
Do you have customers of long standing?
Oh, very much so, very much so. People have been coming 50 years. People come in, they remember when we used to cook them in Strand Arcade in the shop, and as retail customers and also wholesale customers. The wholesale customers, that's a fellow that's our agent now, or the company, would be, 35 years, 40 years? At least, yes, at least.
Is that unusual to have such long-standing...
I don't think it is in the confectionery industry, no. And the same with our suppliers. We've dealt with those for a long, long time. I mean, individual farms and the like.
You mentioned you went into the macadamia business yourself. What prompted you to buy a farm?
Well, macadamia, as you know, are a native Australian nut. And this would have been in the late 60s, I first heard of macadamia. I came actually back from a chocolate convention in Chicago, and I met the fella who owned Hawaiian Host, Mr. Takitani, I think his name was at the time. Very unassuming Japanese man whom I thought he couldn't afford to pay for his stay here, and later found out he was a multi-millionaire. And he had Hawaiian Host in Hawaii, and he allowed me to go through that factory when we went back. And I saw the Japanese walking out with their 10 packs of macadamia clusters, and I thought, gee, I can do that. and it was actually very helpful to me. Mm. And when I tried to buy local macadamia nuts, it was only CSR who first started to grow macadamias here commercially, and I got absolutely nowhere. And I'd had macadamias before from the people who supplied us with peanuts. And they were banana growers, a peanut company of Australia now, but they also sold peanuts at the time. And banana growers at the time had macadamias as windbreaks around their farm. And they came to Sydney in the shell still, not cracked. And there was a little cracking plant in... just down here, I've forgotten the name of the street, and where we could crack them on a Saturday morning again. Sometimes they cracked them for us, and I could never get enough macadamia. Hmm. And then I had a friend of mine who was still in business, George Kemsler, who bought me in the first macadamia kernels from Hawaii. And that was, if I remember rightly, about either half a ton or a ton of macadamia kernels. They were very expensive at the time, and we just salted those, nothing else. It wasn't enough to be chocolate coated or anything like that. And people loved them. Mm. And so this is how I got into the macadamia farm business. When I saw this, I thought the only way to do this is to buy a farm. And together with some people in the family, we bought a 25 hectare property, and we've had that for 35 years. Mm.
It's very much sold overseas as an American nut, Hawaiian nut, still, rather than a traditional Australian product.
Well, there's no question. They developed it. Absolutely no question they developed it. We did absolutely nothing with it till they started it, and people asked us, have you got these nuts? And then when I found that they were really a native Australian nut taken to Hawaii in the 1890s, that I realized, well, they must be able to grow here. But don't forget, at that time, people said, oh, it's all right for Hawaii, they haven't got the pests that we have, flower-eating caterpillar, nut borer, and hundreds of others. But then we had a time where we had the organic chloride sprays, you know, the DDTs,
oh,
and
yes.
This area, you think, and you could buy a drum for about $20, it'll do the whole orchard. And that was very easy and very good. But then later on, we found, of course, that they had residual problems. Mm. So, but in the meantime, we have other sprays that we can use, but that's been a real problem.
Still a problem in that industry?
Well, yes, with the fact that you have these pests and you have to control them. But every industry has that.
Yes. It just seems.
But it isn't as cheap to get rid of it.
It was there?
It is not as cheap to spray.
And no.
You try not to spray. It's, the whole emphasis has changed there.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
but we're talking about the farm.
That's right. No, yes, which is a tangent to your business. So, again, reading through that terrific article of Helen Greenwood's and your literature, you say that things began to change and people wanted different items in the shop. So you moved on from Vienna almonds and macadamias.
Well, the first thing we did, and they were early days then, too, was salted cashews. See, before the war, I'm talking about the Second World War, cashews weren't that well known. They were grown in India, but they were quite an expensive nut and very few shops sold. We were one of the first then to have salted cashews, and they were very popular.
What prompted you to sell them?
Well, they were available.
Did you go to India to source them?
No. We went to an import agent here, but you had to have an import license to get them, you see, and it was very hard, and for a while there we had a lot of problems, and you actually bought the license and took someone else's license to buy the nuts. But they were different years. They were just immediately post-war years, and business was done differently to what it is now. Mm.
The city, I'll come back to the produce you sold, but the city itself was a very small area with a very great number of small businesses in that area. Were you aware of the other businesses in the city and the other restaurants?
Sure. Sure, very much so. But if you have a look at the Pitt Street, now Pitt Street Mall, you had a lot of what you might call small business, but there were very little department stores along there. You know, there was quite a number there. There was McCarthy's, there was Horton, not Horton Brothers, not the big one that's down here, but that was Anthony Horton's, but Horton Brothers was there, and there were several other ones along there. There were really ways, and there were really small department stores. And then farmers, of course, and then David Jones, so that's quite a lot.
Did you supply any of those restaurants?
No, at that stage we only supplied our own shops.
But now you supply restaurants
yes,
with
we
things
do.
Like that?
Yes, that's changed completely.
So how did people respond to this new food item of cashews?
Oh, I mean, people loved cashews and people loved salted almonds and people, all the various things that we cooked there. Mm-hmm. And we also imported Brazils, but not directly, but through an agent. We still do. For a little while, I imported things myself. My son feels it's... I had at the time several suppliers, particularly one Indian one, and with all on... I could guarantee... He guaranteed that he gave me good quality, and we did that. But my son now gets a couple of quotes from different importers, and they're all graded, and we do it that way.
So I get the sense... With you, Paul, that there's a large number of business relationships that you have and have had for a long time.
Yes.
And they've not necessarily... business is done differently now with the next generation in terms of getting quotes or not continuing those personal relationships.
Times have changed. I used to go over to Adelaide by maybe 20, 25 tons of nuts on a handshake. We had no sale notes, we had nothing else. Nowadays everything's done, order numbers and sale notes and so on, but that's the way things have changed. It wasn't only the nut shop, it was everybody else's the same way.
Yes. Would you go overseas on buying trips yourself?
No. Not on buying trips, no. We went overseas, for many years I regularly went to a convention called International International Confectioners. They're still members of that organization. Retail Confectioners International. And they're a group, anything from Darolis, we're also members at the time, and we are, but everything from American companies with, say, 700 shops to the individual shop where Mama sold at the front, Papa made the goods at the back, and that's always been very much also personal contact things. We always found people that we could relate to, and that's been very good. My son finds he hasn't got the time to go to these things as much. He's been to a couple, we're still members, but for argument's sake, there's a company in Canada called Purdy's. They now have about 70 or 80 shops, I think maybe more, and through the contact there, they bought excess macadamia for my farm that I didn't need, and they still take them, and so on. But it's all on a personal thing, and we made very many good friends through that.
Yes, yes. Is there such an organization nationally, or is that the Australian group that you're speaking about?
No, the one I'm speaking about is an American group. They call them Retail Confectioners International.
And is there an Australian similar body?
No, here there's a confectionery association, but that's changed over many years. And it's now includes people like Cadbury's and Nestle and so on as well, in a bigger way. But yes, there is a local association. My son goes to those meetings. Hmm. But we are very small compared to most.
So where do you get things like your chocolate?
We blend our own chocolate. We have our own recipe. Very strict. My son is very precise with that, and he has luckily a very good palate that he can tell the difference. And he says, one bag of this, one bag of that, one bag of that. We use some of the Calabau chocolate. We used to get it from Belgium, but now we get it from Singapore, which we think is equally as good. People think Swiss or Belgian chocolate is better, but it's the same firm making it. And we get some local chocolates. We can go upstairs, you can have a look later, but there's Cadbury, there's Nestle, and there's Calabau, and we just blend it.
And you buy it in the block, you don't buy the cocoa beans?
No, it comes
beans?
In bags. No, look, there's really Cadbury's and Nestle no longer make chocolate from cocoa beans, right? I believe Hague's is the only company that still makes it. I don't know what they make, but it's not very difficult to do, but I think it's very uneconomic to do it. The cocoa bean is now pressed, as they call it, in the country of origin, and they send it out as cocoa butter and cocoa liquor, and then the bigger firms reconstitute it from that.
You don't participate in that sort of production?
No, we just buy our chocolate as chocolate. We use some chocolate liquor because we like to have our dark chocolate, a little bit more bitter than the one that's available. But this is a matter of blending, not a matter of making, of conching the chocolate.
So in a sense, one could suggest you're doing science in any case.
Well,
you wanted
hardly,
to do science.
Hardly.
I think I interrupted you earlier, Paul, when you were going to tell me about the kinds of items that had sold and that sold differently at different times and how that taste had changed.
Well, I think taste changed, yes. We now sell a lot more nuts, natural nuts particularly, because of this Nuts for Life or Nuts for Health campaign. People are much more conscious of the health benefits of nuts, so we sell a lot of either roasted nuts without salt or ordinary kernels, but we also sell a lot of manufactured things, like us, when I show you later, our scorching room is very efficient.
Your scorching room, did
yes,
you say?
Or panning room, whatever you'd like to call it, where we make chocolate almonds, chocolate peanuts, sultanas and things, macadamias, and it goes quite large volumes. Mm. But we do that, but we also like the raw natural nuts and we roast them.
Mm. What about marzipan? Is that still a big seller?
To a certain, how can I put it, to a certain clientele, yes. We don't package ours very well. We only sell it in our own shops. And people know when they're really regular customers that buy that.
Do they buy it to eat as something out of a paper bag, or do they
yes.
buy it for cake?
No. I don't sell the bulk marzipan, only chocolate-coated.
Did you ever sell bulk marzipan?
No, not really, no.
Did you ever import marzipan?
Well, we do import sometimes the marzipan base that we use, and sometimes we make it from the nuts onwards, but it just depends. Sometimes it's much cheaper to buy the base and make it from there onwards than otherwise. And if you can get the good quality, then it's no problem.
Is there a season in the production of...
No, marzipan is... Almonds keep very well, so it is not.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about training your staff, mm-hmm. Paul.
Well, as far as the men are concerned, the confectioners, yes, we do train them sort of separately, with separate things. We've had a guy on now, he would have been here about close on a year, and now he knows how to cook all the salted nuts, and it's quite, we batch cook, so it's not a continuous process, so it's quite different that each nut has to be different time, and even varieties of nuts different times. He does all the roasting, oil roasting and other roasting, and then the chap that does most of the confectionery has been here about over 30 years. Mm. So, and that's sort of, we we teach it as we go along, caramel, brittle, and all the various products. But we were very fortunate that when Carl's closed in the city, we had the main confectioner from there, and I'm still in touch with him. He's still alive, and all the recipes from there and everything. He was very generous with us. He taught us, and so we teach it on to them.
Could I ask what his name is?
Marshal Stoyescu.
Carl's, of course.
But he was Australian-born, returned soldier. He's got a Baltic sort of name, but Stoyescu is his name, Marshal Stoyescu, and he's retired onto Central Coast. He's still alive.
So how did you have that relationship with him?
Well, when they closed down, he was looking for a job. We were very happy to take him, and he was happy to work for us. Matter of fact, at Christmas time, he still gets his nuts sent to him and chocolates, and he always comes back, and he said they're as good as ever, and makes comments about the creams, and occasionally when we drive up north to the farm, we stop and talk to him.
Just coming back to the Strand Arcade, too, you mentioned checkers and your knowledge of checkers. Would you like to tell me about that?
Well, as a young man, you're very much interested in this, and we got good pocket money, if I can, how can I put it? In those days, when you got beer, you didn't get it in cartons. You had a sugar bag, right? You went to the pub with a sugar bag, and they gave you 6 or 8 bottles of beer, right? Now, we went through every day 2 bags of almonds, which at the time fetched about 2 shillings, and sugar bags, which when the fella came for collecting the bag, fetched you 1 shilling. So that was, if you can work it out,
there
was 8 shillings, and that was quite a lot of pocket money to get. And that was my thing. And so we had a little bit of money, and checkers was quite expensive, but you got a meal, you got a floor show and everything else. And I must say, I enjoyed my time at that. Times we went to Checkers. There were other clubs. There was a lot of other ones as well. But Checkers, in particular, at Strand Arcade, had a certain, for me, was the tops. And there was a comedian called Joe Martin. And a lot of the girls that were in the chorus used to go and buy 2 ounces of Vienna almonds. And you got to know them and to see them. And also, when you went down with the lift, you could see them. They were practicing or whatever else. We had, don't forget, we had the rooms upstairs, which was really our factory. We were on 2 separate floors. We had 3 big rooms up there where we made our chocolates. And there was a time I really loved to remember. It was a great time. Mm. And they were very popular, particularly with the racing fraternity. And they had really a great kitchen, a great meal, and a very good floor show. And when you worked it out, it wasn't all that expensive.
So it was quite a sophisticated aspect of Sydney life at that time.
Very much so.
And you're living back in Randwick. Were you aware of that?
No, we were living at that time in East Lakes.
East Lakes. So you were in the suburbs, and you were working in this very sophisticated atmosphere with Checkers nearby. Were you aware of the...
As a young man, you're not aware. You're just looking for the day.
But all those glamorous girls and that glamorous...
Yes, they were. They certainly were.
...aspect of life. Mm.
But it was certainly a part of the city and part of Strand Arcade, yes. Particularly Checkers.
Yes. Would you take time off from the shop to slip down and watch them practice?
Not really, no. But always as a special thing, I didn't go all that often. But once every 2 months, you'd have a meal there and take in a new floor show or whatever it was. And very much so, particularly had different girlfriends before at that time, and it was made quite an impression. It was really very good. And good value, I would thought.
Well, Paul, you've been very generous this afternoon, and I'm conscious that the day is moving on. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about particularly that you'd like to record about the nut shop?
No, but as I say, we had shops sort of both ends of the city. George Street was one part near Liverpool Street. Then I thought I'd like to be Circular Quay with expanding. They were building the AMP Centre at the time, so we took the shop at Wynyard Station. And then later on, we were in with the original development of Australia Square. Harry Seidler even helped us to design the inside of the shop. So we were very conscious of the city as such for us, for productions, for goods, and we had a lot of customers from those various branches.
Just as we wind up, would you say your customers were mostly city-based? You said that you had a number of...
No, see, it was quite different. In the original days, people put on their hats and gloves and once a week came to town because there was no shopping in any of the suburbs, really not. It was quite different. And people used to come in, especially Thursdays and Fridays, and come in and shop in town. Now, bit by bit, as suburbs expanded, as supermarkets expanded, that stopped.
And but even somewhere like Rosedale, what was it,
Roseville, Bankstown.
That place near Bankstown,
Roselands.
Roselands.
We had a shop in Roselands. Mm. We had a shop in Roselands. But that was the first of the big centres with the Rainbow Fountain, if you remember that.
Very special.
It was very special. It was something completely new. Mm. And that killed the city for a while. It was a long while till the city population and even people now come to the city again. But for a long while they didn't. So we had the... Our regulars had come once every few months, perhaps, from overseas or from Hornsby or Bankstown. And then we had the city workers who are still sort of for lunchtime the major part of our business and always have been.
How many people do you have in the shop now?
Always four, but sometimes five because we have an upstairs and we weigh up. Mm. We pack.
You've been very generous this afternoon, Paul. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.